This is the Coast and Country podcast from the BBC. You can find the terms and conditions on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Today you can hear Open Country with Helen Mark.
I'm looking out across Camloch, which is this beautiful piece of still water high up in the Sperrin Mountains in County Tyrone in Northern Ireland. So still are the waters here that there's a very deep fringe of reeds which cushion the edge of the water. On the far side there's a couple of water hens there and some swans. And it's from this loch that a most beautiful river rises, the Ballanderry River. And just beside me here there's this almost like seepage down over the grass. And very slowly it becomes a trickling brook past hedges thick with crimson-red berries and gorse bushes, and then through a copse of bare-branched trees which are so laden with moss. They look as though they may give way under the weight of it. This is the head of the Ballanderry. What a beautiful place for a river to rise. It makes its way down through County Tyrone, eventually reaching Loch Ney, and it's this river that I've come to explore, not just because of its beauty, because this is a place where a unique and very special river project is taking place, connecting people once again with its waters. And I'm going to start in quite an unexpected place.
What we'll do is we'll step into the water here and we'll lift some stones, and hopefully you'll see them dashing away for all they're worth.
It's really just a short walk from where the river rises to where I am now, and I'm actually in the middle of a working sand and gravel pit. This is where a very special project connected with the Ballanderry River is actually happening. And Mark Horton, who's the coordinator of the White Clawed Crayfish Project,
right,
is with me. And the quarry is owned by Atchison and Glover, and Aaron Curry is with us from the quarry. And this is really special, isn't it? This lake that's in front of us now, surrounded by little sort of hummocks of hills. The rattling of the machinery behind us.
That's right.
But what about the water in there?
Well, this is very special water because this is the first ark site for crayfish in Ireland.
What's an ark site?
Well, just like the ark itself, when creatures were taken on, as the story goes, to protect them. You know, this is what this site is here, is to protect the white-clawed crayfish. So we've brought crayfish here to this lake, which is protected, and it acts like an ark to preserve them for the future.
And they've been brought from the Ballanderry River?
That's right, yeah.
Into here?
From the bottom of the Ballanderry up to the very, very top.
Well, let's just edge our way down a little bit. And Aaron, tell me about what it is that the quarry actually did to create this habitat.
What we did was we created a 60-metre-long habitat bay. We brought in about 1,500 tonnes of our hollow core flooring slabs.
So this is this stone embankment that we're just walking along the edge of?
Yes.
Yeah.
Then we used, you can see, the larger rocks from our quarry to sit over the top of the concrete slabs. And then we topped it off with, you can see, with this. It's like a decorative gravel.
You've created an embankment along which the crayfish do what? How does this all tie in?
Well, when we arrived at this lake originally, there was a very shallow shoreline all the way around it. And the crayfish need somewhere to get into. They need all little nooks and crannies to live in, you see. We also have house bricks, and they're the type of house bricks that have holes in them. And they make great homes for crayfish, just like they make good homes for people, because the crayfish can reverse into the little holes and they can live in each one in a different hole.
Now, we have our Wellingtons on, so we can go down onto the very edge. But if we're lucky, we might see some of these crayfish, because they are a very rare species, aren't they? Very endangered.
They are. They're globally threatened. And here in the British Isles and Ireland, they're under considerable stress. There's been lots of damage to rivers in the past. You know, the water quality is not as good as it used to be. Habitat's been damaged. So that's why we've come here, where the clean water is and where the good habitat is, to help these little guys on, you know. Have to lift the stone very, very carefully to see them. Yes, there's one there. Can you see two there?
There it comes. It's coming my way. Now, it's only about an inch and a half long, if that.
Yes, and one has just darted off in the other direction there towards the wood bundles.
And so this one is hiding behind a stone there, and in with the gravel bottom, doesn't it have the most fantastic camouflage?
Yes.
You can barely see it. Only when it just inches itself along the lake bottom that you can see it.
But do you see how small that one is?
Yeah.
That's one of the babies that has been born in this lake as a result of the project. See, the ones that were put in were adults, and they would be about 10, 12 centimetres in length. So that's one of the babies. Probably not last year, but the year before, that one was born in the lake, and now you're seeing it swimming around. So evidence that the project's working.
And will you be there, Aaron, when they release the first white-clawed crayfish back into the Ballanderry?
I think so.
I think you should be.
I think it's really a must, isn't it?
I think so, definitely. There's a lot of pride around the project.
And there really is.
It's very, very exciting.
So the crayfish that we've just seen, they will eventually be reintroduced back into the Ballanderry River, this wonderful stretch of water which is about 45, 46, 47 kilometres long,
right, yeah.
And it heads down and ends up in Loch Ney.
Mm-hmm.
And this river has been the focus of a lot of attention of late, hasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
With something called Ripple.
Which stands for Rivers Involving People, Places and Leading by Example.
And you're the coordinator of that as well, Mark.
That's right,
well,
yes.
This great crayfish.
I wear many, many hats. But the Ripple project is a WWF project. They needed someone to help them deliver a river project, and so they came to us and asked us to do that. We're a river trust, a charity, so we're best placed within the community to help the community develop their own river management plan, which is what Ripple is all about.
And that's what's special about this Ripple project, isn't it? It's about reconnecting people with their Ballanderry River again.
That's right, yes.
And they had lost that connection.
A lot of people have, and it's happened very, very quickly, because there's people today who, within living memory, remember as children being sent to the river to wash, to get water. The fish that were caught were put on the table for their tea, and all that's gone. I mean, the younger people of today, you know, maybe the 10, 12, 15, 16-year-olds, they're not going to the river anymore. They don't think about the river. So what we're trying to do with Ripple is get people back onto it again. And the more people understand about it, the better people will, you know, protect it and have pride in it.
So in our journey down the river, we're going to be meeting some of the people who are directly involved in activities along the banks and on the water.
Yes.
All the way down.
That's
that,
right.
That lovely run to Loch Ney. Canoe. Long canoe. We're just sliding it down a quite muddy bank and onto the water there. And Eddie Black, who is my canoeist for this part of the exploration of the Ballanderry, is just bringing the canoe alongside.
Just setting the boat up so it's easy for you to get in and out of it.
Right.
And you're wearing all the correct safety stuff.
Got my
buoyancy aid in.
Yep.
If you just want to step down into your position in the boat, feel it just.
Yeah, feel it giving way.
The balance changes.
Okay.
That's fine, that's natural. And if you just make yourself low in the boat. Perfect. Are you comfortable?
I am. So you're a canoeist, Eddie, and a member of Kildress Angling Club, which is the area we're in now, isn't it, Kildress?
We're right in Kildress Angling Club waters, about 2.5 miles upstream of Cookstown. I was brought up here as a child. And we would have went down to a local filling station and blown up a tractor tube and carried it up here amongst a crowd of us and jumped into the river and had a bit of a swim, you know. So here we are now, and you know, got ourselves jobs and bought a few boats. So we've just upgraded a little bit.
But the pleasure's still the same, is it?
It's all the same. We get the same fun from it, you know. And what we're trying to do now is promote that again, give it new life. And try and get young people out and involved in the river like we were back then. We go down over the same waterfalls we did then. It's just a lot of fun.
Waterfalls?
That won't be today. We'll just leave it. We'll admit that for today. So, just with all the work the local people do here, through volunteer groups and with Ripple and that, everything's kept in such pristine condition. Again, with the canoeing, we don't want to disturb that at all. We just want for all our people to enjoy that as well.
There's such a peace, though, isn't there? Just the creak of the boat and the splash of the paddle.
Yeah, it takes you away from it all. You know? You're out of the buzz of the town and mainstream life, and just enjoying the countryside. There's a dipper just now in front of us.
They are dippers, aren't they? So they do that lovely little bob, 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 bob at the side of the water on the gravel and stones that are there. And we're so close to the bank now, and you can see how the water, obviously at times of flood, has gouged away underneath. So you have these overhangs of vegetation, but just look how there are lots of holes and places for creatures to hide or to take up home. Oh, it's so cold. Clean. Look at that lovely clean water, tinted with brown, like weak brown tea. It's very relaxing. So here I am back on dry land on the riverbank of the Ballanderry, and I actually think I made quite a good exit point because I can hear the fast water just ahead of me. So I'm going to walk along this bit of the river in the company of Kevin Johnson, because Kevin, you are involved with looking at the wildlife of the Ballanderry River. So let's walk and talk.
Yes, okay.
What was so lovely there out on the water, Kevin. Absolutely lovely. What a great way to get a sense of the river and to see wildlife. We saw a couple of dippers.
Did you see any mink?
No, no.
Well, while I was waiting for you there, I noticed a commotion amongst the trout. Several of them skipped out of the water, and one quite large trout jumped clear of the water. Then shortly afterwards, a small trout, something like a quarter of a pound, came to the surface on its side and flapped about for a bit. Just after that, it came to the surface again and was pushed into the side by something underwater, which was undoubtedly a mink.
A mink rather than an otter?
Yes, I'm afraid so. An otter would have taken it cleanly and may actually have gone for the bigger fish rather than the small one. We have quite a few mink here. At one stage, they were very bold and you would have seen them quite openly, but more recently, there seem to be some signs that the otters are fighting back.
And this is all part of what you're doing. We've mentioned three species there in just in the few steps that we've taken, the dipper, the otter, the mink.
Yes.
And it's your role to compile what's described as like almost like an atlas of the wildlife of the river.
Yes, what I'm trying to do is to find what there is along the river, both what there is naturally and what has been here since the early days, since pre-Christian times, but also what has come in and become part of the river.
Why do you feel it's important that this is done, this whole wildlife aspect of the overall Ripple project?
I think it needs to be done because people are starting to feel, through television programmes, through radio programmes, are starting to feel closer to their wildlife, and they're starting to question their own effect on wildlife. One of the problems in Ireland is that houses are built all around the countryside, and most of them have septic tanks. Now, these septic tanks may have been put in 1960 or 1970. Nobody knows if they're working yet. More and more houses are being put in. There is more effluent coming through. And we know, for example, the management plan for Loch Ness specifies that its water quality is bad. Not poor, bad. We know that diving duck numbers are decreasing on Loch Ness. The fish species are coming under threat. We know there are fewer eels, for example, and yet this was one of the greatest eel fisheries in Europe. And what we want to do is to let people see that they have, what they are doing, how they are living, is having an effect on the river and an effect on the wildlife. This river has had people living along it since Mesolithic times.
You see, this was a river that people were connected to, obviously, for all that length of time,
all
back to Mesolithic times. But it was a place of, well, I use the word a bit generally, but industry.
Yes.
And so that was their connection.
Yes. The water seems to be moving very slowly past here. It's a fairly steady flow. But the power of that water was enough to drive mill wheels, and those mill wheels were used to drive different instruments that were used in the preparation of linen.
And it was a very, very important industry, and that was a direct connection with the river.
Yes.
When the linen went,
yes,
people lost that connection.
That's right, and it's the only connection for a long time, the only connection people have with the river has been fishing. And it's only the fisherman that knew what was happening to the river, and he saw his fish die off he began to question things. And it's that questioning that has moved out from there to the general population. The whole biodiversity seems to be diminished at the minute.
Well, this looks really interesting here because we've got the weir just going over these stones, so we'll get quite interesting sounds coming out of here, John.
Yeah, I think the sounds from the trees will be nice as well.
There's good shelter.
I'm about 5 miles now further downstream through Cookstown and outside the village of Coch. And the river's much broader here. It's about 30 feet across and the flow is a lot faster. And down on the riverbank, we've got Professor Paul Moore and his associate, John. And they are doing the most unusual project I have ever heard of to do with a river. So I'm just going to go down the bank. What's interesting here, too, is that the leaf litter has changed a lot. Higher up, there were lots of birches. Here, I'm down into oaks. I'm down into the strippy leaves of ash, I think that is. So this is a constantly changing environment, this riverbank. It's wonderful. So you've lots of kit here, Paul.
Yes, well, this project, it's our first time here as well. Actually, a very beautiful spot it is. We've been working our way down the rivers as well. We initially worked on the River Foyle. And what we're trying to do really is to give a voice to places that one somehow imagines as silent places. I know that sounds ridiculous because we've water running, but it seems as though it's the same sound all the time. But we wanted to turn it into a voice. And what we're trying to do now is to try and create a situation where, using the web, we might get every river in the north of Ireland singing at the same time on the web simultaneously.
A river singing, Paul?
Well, what we do is, using microphones and using sensors, we take the sound of the river and we feed it then to a computer patch which my colleague John Harding and Brian Bridges, I better mention them, and Greg O'Hanlon have put together. And that computer program changes the natural sound literally into kind of voice drones, which then give you a sound of the river. Quite melodic. But you also get the natural sounds as well. It's all mixed on any one occasion.
So the breeze that's picked up and rustling the leaves.
The rustling of the leaves, the breeze, the birds singing. Depending where you are, you might have cattle and sheep. Even cars going past create a really interesting ambience with
the
river.
In the water?
In the water.
So how do you actually do that? Show me. Give me
well, show you. Okay, well, what we have here is one of the microphones we use, specially constructed microphone.
Well, it's not unlike ours, actually.
It's not unlike yours until you open it and get a look at the actual microphone itself. Because the actual microphone itself has got like a four-way head. And if we get down in very close to the river, which we can do here, and John can then monitor, and he can see as well as hear that you're getting... It's almost quadraphonic sound coming from the river, and we would mix that when we had the sensors in with what was coming out from the sensors as well.
Do you go underwater?
No, the sensors just float, and they have got kind of transducers in them which lift it.
I see.
And then they pull it from the river, feed it back in with the microphone sounds, and they're then programmed through this processor which John and my colleagues have written. And then that's fed into the computer, which hopefully John can fire up for us at some point and get going.
Are you doing this whole program through the University of Ulster?
It's through the University of Ulster and an organisation called Music 55-7 who were very instrumental in getting us the funding. But the beauty of it is it can go back into the community. That's the really crucial thing. This is about taking this river back into choirs, back into school choirs, back into community choirs, and letting them sing with it, and letting them see that the work we do in the university isn't removed, actually. It's part of the community.
And at the heart of the Ripple Project is this reconnection of people who live and work along the banks of the Ballanderry, back with the water, the running of the water, and, you know, its stories and what it's meant to people, and... Now they can do it with the sounds as well.
Every single place in Northern Ireland and England and Wales and Scotland has a particular sound identity. They have sound marks, the same as their landmarks. There's a soundscape, the same as their landscape. Okay, so what we have now is the sounds are coming from the river, they're being fed into the laptop, and it's producing the river singing. So the river is dictating actually what its voice is.
So we're gathering in the sound of the water somehow and transforming it. And you can hear all sorts of things in there, can't you? Like, you can hear the run of the water, yes, but you can also hear... It's not... I know it's not a wail, but it's that... Sometimes I go, and tinkling sounds and...
You can hear a river there. You can hear a burbling and a river there.
But then you've got this wonderfully ethereal voice, as though it's coming from the past, as though it's coming from the future, as though it's crying out to the people around it. And it's this wonderful, almost like a wheel. Not the sea wheel, but the other wheel, almost like a banshee wheel, kind of coming back and calling from the river. And I can get very romantic and silly about it, but I hear different things every time I hear it. And the crucial thing is, we never know what we're going to get, because the river, as it should, dictates what its final voice is.
So there, 47 kilometres. That's how far it is from the head of the Ballanderry River down here to Loch Ney.
Yes.
One of how many rivers flow into Loch Ney?
Six rivers, yeah.
Flow into this magnificent piece of water,
yes,
in the very heart of Northern Ireland, the vast stretch of water. And I'm here with Seamus Burns, who's with the RSPB.
This place touches five of the six counties in Northern Ireland. And peak times, back in the mid-1980s, late 1980s, this place had something like 100,000 diving duck come in here for the winter. So it was a huge number of birds that would have used this site. Still today, there are quite a lot. It's a very, very good site as a wintering grounds for birds, a very important site, and it's got international designations because of its importance as a wetland.
But you're saying there's been a drop in numbers?
There has been a drop in numbers, Helen, over the years. We're not quite sure what is happening. It could be ecological. It could be something that's happening when the rivers flow into the loch. There could be something with the water quality that's affecting the birds coming across. It could be climate. And so it could be that birds are no longer coming this far south any longer. They're stopping off on their way across.
They don't need to come here to get the warmer weather because it's happening,
yeah,
further north.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but that's all speculation. We don't really know. But the thing to bear in mind is, because we don't know, we've got to be very careful about sites like this and what happens in river catchments such as in the Ballanderry that you've been to today.
This is a lovely time to be here with you, Seamus, because we're coming towards the end of the day. So just as we've been standing here for even a short space of time, we've got quite a bit of gathering of activity,
yeah,
out there. Look. Are those hooper swans?
We have hooper swans,
uh-huh,
just arriving in, so we're at the end of October, so hooper swans begin to congregate here now, so we've up to 1,500 hooper swans would spend the winter about this area. We've got diving duck, as I mentioned earlier, so there's tufted duck, scop, goldeneye and pochard congregating out in the loch, they're just arriving on Loch Ney. You've got other birds that don't dive for their food, but known as dabbling duck, so things like widgeon, teal and so on, they're coming to the shallower edges of the loch. And areas like Loch Beg, which is just adjacent to Loch Ney.
So all those species depend on the water being a good resource for them, full of food, unpolluted. And that will only happen if the rivers flowing into it are healthy. And that is really what they're trying to do with the Ballanderry, isn't it? As well as connecting it to people, making it as pristine,
yes,
as possible. So it's not pouring out lots of disgustingness into this magnificent,
yes,
Loch Ney. What is the largest loch?
It's the largest
lake.
The whole of the British Isles. So it's a 383 square kilometre stretch of water. So there's a lot of activity on rivers such as the Ballanderry that can affect it. But you mentioned something that's very, very important when we think about the whole landscape scale, management and restoration of our landscapes. It's people. You know, wildlife, the birds and so on are important in these areas. These areas are important for those different birds that I've just mentioned. But it's people that are important within the landscape that ensures that these things exist in the future. People are connected a lot with the landscape and with the wildlife about the area. So it's linking all of that back to how we actually manage and how we take care of it. It's thinking backwards and upwards and up into the uplands in terms of what we're doing.
And back to where I began this week's Open Country, and that was right up in the Sperrins at Camloch.
Yes.
Where,
right,
it gently seeps out of that reservoir of water, as it were, and ends up in this one.
Well, that's it. This site drains the third of Northern Ireland, but quite a lot of people in Northern Ireland take the drinking water from Loch Ney. So the quality of the water that's running off those different landscapes into Loch Ney is affecting the birds, it's affecting the people as well.
So, you know, over the day, I have travelled from the head of the river down its 47 kilometres right to where the Ballanderry flows into Loch Ney, and I've been hearing the stories of the river and the people who live and work alongside it. And in a way, I suppose that story is coming to a close here at Loch Ness. But when you look out over this great expanse of water, you just have this feeling that another story is just about to begin.